Let's see. So now this is 8 p.m. on East Coast time, right? So I'll be on East Coast time pretty soon. And next week, next Sunday, and possibly even the Sunday after that, I'll be on the East Coast.
Okay.
But I'm sure that doesn't change anything for you.
I don't believe so.
Okay. All right. All right, very good. Well, it seems to be 5 o'clock right now, so you think we should go ahead and get started?
That sounds good, yeah.
Okay, very good. So welcome to our coaching call for this evening. We have a wonderful opportunity for us to kind of continue and flesh out some of the things that we discussed last week in our last coaching call. Of course, if you're coming back and listening to these in the recordings, and we certainly hope that you are, just know that these are a series of coaching calls that each one of them stands alone, really, as an element of education and at the same time an element of perspective. And so you can mix and match, take them in order, take them out of order, and they should all make complete sense or perfect sense. Let's hope that's the way it works. That's certainly the way I designed it. So let's take ourselves back through what coaching is and what coaching is not. First thing to know is that this is a friends and family call, right? This is not a business call, right? So if you have some business interest, if you'd like to become a health coach yourself, this is certainly your launching pad, it's your starting point. But contact the person that invited you to opt in for the weekly Clarity Report. That can help you with your coaching career, and we can also that way get you specifics on our call each week. As I said, this is not a sales call. There's no business opportunities. You're not being asked to join a secret cult or a secret club. No secret handshakes. We don't have a code ring, and we don't even have a special whistle. It's just coaching. And remember, as we have spoken many times before, is that coaching has an assumption that goes with it about the person who's being coached, whether you're self-coaching, coaching within your family, or coaching a client as a professional health coach. There is an assumption, and it's what coaching is not and what coaching is that kind of helps us surround this assumption. What coaching is not? Coaching is not expert advice. This isn't the case where you're looking at yourself as being an expert and the other person as being a novice. It's not as if someone is deficient in any way. So don't think that you need to be an expert on every topic or every subject in order to be a health coach. No one is. No one can be. And further, no one really wants to be. What we want is then to have the person be the expert on their own life. You see, no matter what we do, we can be an expert on a subject. No matter what we study, I like to say that every topic that we study, every topic is like real estate. No matter how small your real estate is, it's really, really deep, right? It goes all the way to the center of the earth. So no matter what subject you're an expert in, you can't be an expert on anyone's life except your own. Every person is an expert on their own life. They're a freaking PhD on them, right? Just like you're a PhD on you. And you certainly don't want somebody coming by telling you about your life, would you? So when we're coaching someone, we have to remember that the thing people are actually missing is not information and not advice. What they're missing is clarity. So we're not dealing under what coaching is not. Coaching is not an expert versus novice relationship. A coach is not a teacher. He's not a consultant. He's not a surrogate parent. A doctor is not a coach when he's acting as a physician, giving, for example, a diagnosis from his vast medical expertise to somebody who has an illness. Instead, a coach is someone who assumes that the person in front of them, the person they're coaching, even if the person's in the mirror, right, that the person is, there's nothing wrong with them. They don't need fixing. They're not broken. The assumption is that this is an individual who needs clarity, and that's all. So when we look at somebody who's coming to us for coaching, they're going to bait us. I will guarantee you they're going to want you to live their life for them, even though you're an absolute novice about their life and they're a PhD about their life. Let me tell you something. they're going to want, they're going to bait you into trying to give them advice. And of course, that starts the whole victim rescuer model, where they'll be saying, yeah, but that advice won't work because, right? Don't fall into the trap. You don't know about their life nearly as much as they know about their life. So let's just relax into the coaching process. And we'll keep coming back to the basic questions, right? What do you want? And what's important about what you want? Make a list, right? Why is too big of a question for now? We'll get into that later on. Let's just talk about what you want and what's important to you about what you want. What are your strengths? What are your challenges, or otherwise known as your weaknesses? What should you do to get what you want? And then what will you do to get what you want? When will it be done? By whom will it be done? What's your scale of commitment? What type of accountability can you and I co-design, right? We assign that accountability, and then the moment they take action, that sparks the new cycle of coaching. Of course, if they don't take action, there's no need for any more coaching. We wait until, after we have created that accountability, we wait until action starts. So how often would a person come for professional coaching? Well, they may come daily or twice a day, or they may come monthly or annually. When do they actually have the action? That's when you know they're ready to take the next step. So we had discussed a little on our last call about the birth of habits and how habits will affect an individual, and this becomes very important when we're coaching, because we're looking for that moment of dawning comprehension when somebody actually holds their hand up and says, wow, I get it, I see. Yeah, this is what I need to do, this is what I will do, this is what I have done, am doing, right? And then at that moment, you, the coach, become virtually invisible in the relationship. Because remember, it was never about you. You have no expertise, you have no magic. That individual has all the power within them that they ever need if they could only gain the clarity around that vision of theirs. That vision will impel them and compel them and launch them to stratospheric heights that you and I never could have dreamt for them. So the moment that they find that magic, they find that power, you are now invisible in the relationship. And that's the goal of coaching, to make yourself invisible, to make yourself unnecessary. We say you're going to make yourself obsolete, work yourself out of a job. But we talked a little bit about how habits compel people in their day-to-day action. And we even mentioned that habits are as much as 40 to 80% of our daily activity is grounded in habit. But let's go back and just kind of talk about what that means and what habits really are. Habits are actions, right? They're daily actions or they're annual actions. That's not important. A connection by time is not really relevant. An action arises as a response to a feeling, right? There's a feeling first, then an action. Where do feelings come from? Feelings come from thoughts. The architecture of our thoughts dictates what feelings may come from that thought pattern. Thoughts are anchored in values. Our beliefs are the filter for selecting our values, right? We don't all have the same values. But I was looking at the website, values.com, and I kind of got, you know, as we get into the, values.org, we kind of get into the search for value. I found a list of values, right, a list of values. And very modestly, very humbly at the beginning of the list, it said, there's no way that this can be a comprehensive list. And I liked that. That made me smile and allowed me to relax. Nobody's going to tell me what my values are. They're personal to me. And frankly, at the beginning of a coaching session, I may not even be able to express to you what the values are. As we explore them, as time goes along, I may understand my own values that then help me select my beliefs. And it's in that belief selection where habits are formed. Because habits are something that we do without thinking. Once upon a time, a value allowed us to select a belief. That belief then formed itself into a habit by a chain of events that we've already discussed and that we'll discuss again. And then it's set. It's locked in. It's welded in place, and it's not going anywhere until we consciously decide to change it. So a habit is something we do without really thinking about it. And much of our daily activity is based on habits. Again, as I mentioned a moment ago, 40 to 80% of what we do in a day. How are habits formed? Well, we get into what's called learning theory. And there are a number of people from Pavlov to Thorndike to Skinner and many more that have been involved in trying to decide or learn how we learn. And they create this process that they call learning theory that says if we have what we call an approved behavior, and that approved behavior is met with a reward. Now think about the dolphin jumping through the hoop and getting a fish, right? If the approved behavior is met with a reward, we tend to repeat the behavior. Isn't that interesting? We repeat behaviors that are rewarded. Now, in a habit, that reward system may have been locked in decades ago, right? Somebody patted you on the head for tying your shoes, right? What a smart little child you are. Somebody patted you on the head for brushing your teeth, right? And that reward gets locked in. Even though you're not rewarded right now, you just keep right on repeating that behavior until, of course, the behavior goes extinct. And if you stop rewarding a behavior, oftentimes there's a chance for it to become extinct. However, we also have to look at the other side of that coin, right? This is approved behavior, reward, repeat, right? Unapproved behavior, punishment, or in scientific terms we say noxious response, a noxious response, right? A smack on the hand, a scolding look or word, right? A noxious response, we tend to avoid that behavior. And that's the birthplace of habits. Now imagine the decisions that you think you make and that I think I make every day that are probably habits. When we pick out our clothes, when we select our diet, as we cope with stress, whether or not we trust someone, those are all basic habits that we learned long before we participated in them, right? These were things we learned back when we were really at the whim of those people in our immediate culture. So we choose and we decide those things based on habit rather than on selection. That's why it's always good to get a second opinion on certain things. The habits are formed before we actually got to participate in them. They're not really our own. They can become our own if we ourselves learn to participate in the selection of our beliefs and our values. These usually reflect the values of our culture, and I say our immediate culture because it includes our parents, our teachers, and other authority figures that are around us by the time we're, get ready for this, by the time we're around age 7 or 8. Now, according to Chinese philosophy, it's 7 for girls, 8 for boys. But we all knew that girls tend to mature a little bit more quickly than boys do. And so the life cycle goes in 7 and 8 year cycles, according to Chinese philosophy. It goes in 7 and 8 year cycles throughout the rest of life. But our values then are habitually ingrained in us by our culture, that is our parents and our teachers and other valuable people to us, before we're 7 or 8 years old. And then, of course, they're refined as life goes on, and some are discarded and others are adopted. But it tells us all the time, do we still want to behave the way we did when we were 7 or 8? Well, you know what? Some things are worth holding on to. That's why we learn those valuable life lessons when we're young. But it does pay to evaluate our habits through the filter of our current values to make sure that they're efficiently aligned with our beliefs. Habits are also a very effective way of helping us develop a social conscience. Any community, it doesn't matter what the community is, whether you're going to the gym or going to church, any community develops harmony by rewarding good behavior and penalizing bad behavior. And good and bad, of course, approved and unapproved, are decided by the group. But we learn to fit into that group by habit. And then we become a part of that community. We're accepted. Our family, our school, our religious affiliation, they all reward acceptable behavior. They all punish bad behavior. And we learn to fit in when we continually, consistently, and predictably repeat that approved behavior and then avoid the bad behavior. We're accepted. We're even loved based on the behavior grounded in habits approved by our immediate culture. So that's why we have to understand if we want to break an old, habit, we've got to associate that with this whole idea of learning theory. We've got to reward the good, punish the bad. There's got to be a penalty there. Even when we're trying to do this for ourselves, self-coaching, we say, we will tend to repeat behaviors that are rewarded. We will tend to avoid behaviors that are punished. And so that is the way we can cultivate our own habits. And so now, with that in mind, let's go back to our first coaching question. What do you want? When it comes to a habit, think in terms of habits that you want to practice and habits that you want to discard. It's easier, of course, always to start a new habit than it is to break an old habit. I have a very dear friend who said, I can teach you to start a new habit in 2 minutes, less than 2 minutes. Here's what he says. He says, what if you decided you wanted to have a new habit of doing some daily spiritual or devotional or self-improvement reading every single day? That's what you want to do. He says, here's what you do. You put your daily devotional or your daily the daily reading matter that you want to have, you put it under your toothbrush, right? So that when you pick up your toothbrush in one hand, you pick up your book in the other hand. I guess we'd all use e-readers now. If you pick up one, you pick up the other. And while you brush your teeth, you're doing your daily reading. And he said, that's the instant habit. And bless his heart, he was right. When we associate things, we have a tendency to repeat them. So find yourself an anchor somewhere. I can tell you that in biofeedback therapy, especially when we're trying to help somebody learn to have a lower arousal level on stress, we would give them little dots, and they would affix these dots in various places, like on the rearview mirror of their car, like on their wristwatch or on their cell phone. P.S., this was way before the days of cell phones. And we would affix these little dots in places where they would see them and remember to make a contract with himself to take a single deep breath when they saw these little dots. So when they walked through the door, through a doorway, when they picked up a phone, when they looked in their rearview mirror, when they glanced at their watch, they would see these dots, and the contract was, you will take a deep breath when that happens. Just like that. And within a very few weeks, their baseline stress level had been lowered. And within a very few months, they had created an entirely new set of habits. And before the year was out, the architecture of their brain actually changes. See, remember the old saying, form follows function? What that means is that if you change your habit, you'll change the structure. Just like if you were to lift weights every day, several times a day, I'm going to lift weights. Why, within the year, your form would change? Well, that's the same thing that happens to your brain. When you learn to lower that state of arousal, that state of anxiety, by doing just a single deep breath every time you see one of these little reminders, the next thing you know, you've created a new habit and new architecture for your brain. Interesting, isn't it? But we mentioned a moment ago about love. Is love a habit? Remember, a habit is something that we do without really thinking about it. Habits were formed before we participated in selecting our beliefs and values that were truly our own. We learn to fit in. We learn that when we repeat an approved behavior and avoid an unapproved behavior, we're accepted. We are loved based on behavior that's grounded in habits that is usually a part of our immediate culture. So habits are formed because we consistently and predictably are rewarded for certain behavior. We need this approval. We crave this approval. So habits are founded in behavior approved by people who matter to us. Fitting in means that we're accepted by people who matter to us. One definition of love is acceptance plus joy. Now, that's, of course, a mathematician's definition, right? Acceptance plus joy equals love. But what's the message of love? What's the message of acceptance? It means that we matter. It means that we matter to the people who matter to us. Habits are formed when a behavior is rewarded by people that matter to us. And habits are a way that we matter to them. So we go back to the original question, will people die if they don't matter? And the answer is yes. People die without love. Remember, love equals acceptance plus joy to the people who matter to us, and people die when they don't matter. That's why we hold on to some of the habits, even bad habits, so tightly. We'll have difficulty breaking a habit if the habit was formed at a time when the habit made us matter. I always think about ordering pizza with all of my friends when I was young, before I was married and I was in school, and all my friends were in school, and we would go have pizza. And I hate to admit it, sometimes we'd even have beer with that pizza. And you know what? That's nothing but heartache to me right now, and heartache and heartburn. There's no way that I could get away with something like that, and it has no allure to me from a dietary perspective. But, oh, do I remember those days. You know, the times with my lads, my friends, eating pizza and drinking beer. That habit was formed at a time when eating pizza and drinking beer made me matter to that immediate culture. Of course, this isn't about me, but I'm guessing that while I'm telling that story, you're thinking of things that you do that also made you matter at a time when you were younger, and probably a lot more foolish than we are today. That's okay. This is all part of life, right? We fit in with that social group. But it was more than just fitting in. We die without love. We die when we don't matter. So those habits are a way of us fitting into a social group when it was a question of our very survival. Outsiders, outcasts, they have a tendency to get sick. They have a tendency to die at a much younger age. We just reviewed today some of the statistics around bachelors and how the lifespan of a bachelor is only 57 compared to a married man, which is nearly 75 years of age. Right? They matter. Whereas bachelors who have isolated themselves, isolated people don't matter to anyone. They die at a much younger age. Now let's get off that morose topic and talk about personal bad habits. Start using your time to trace the roots of those habits back to their beginning. No matter what the habit is, start with something benign and harmless and innocuous, and then go back and ask yourself, where did it start? Right? Where did it start? And after all these years, why do you still practice that bad habit? You know, why do you sit down at supper time and turn on the TV? Right? That's a very bad habit. The habit is usually formed as a way of making this matter. Now let's think of a really bad habit, smoking. Why in the world would anyone start smoking? Everyone knows and has known for decades what a harmful habit smoking is. Those that start smoking usually take that first painful puff as a way of fitting in or making themselves matter to people that mattered to them at that moment. All these years later, of course, they still have that habit. Some of that's addiction. Some of it's habit based on the fact that this is how they mattered at that time. And with every puff, which is not quite as painful as it was right at first, any of you who've ever tried a cigarette know exactly what I'm talking about. This is a painful experience. Why in the world would anybody do something like that? It's because it made them matter. And we all crave that as a matter of survival for us to fit in. Think of a good habit. Trace that good habit back to its roots, back to its beginning. Why, after all these years, do you still practice that good habit? Often the habit was formed as a way of making you matter. We talked about brushing your teeth. Everyone knows that brushing your teeth is good for your dental health. Guess what? Recent data shows that it's good for your mental health as well. Dental health, mental health, cardiovascular health. Yet, we didn't know that when we first started brushing our teeth. We only knew that it pleased our parents or other figures that mattered to us at the time, and that made us matter. So if you've ever started a new habit, you know how difficult it was unless you had a partner that shared with you in the creation of the habit. That's why we have workout buddies, right, and study buddies. If you've ever broken a habit, you know how difficult that was unless you had a partner that shared in the process, which is why things like Weight Watchers, Overeaters Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, things like that work so well, and I mean so, so well, because we've got a partner to share in that process, and we matter to that group when we're successful. In breaking or creating a habit, there had to be someone or something that really mattered to us as a source of power. And nothing is more powerful than love as a motivation for a habit. Why? Because love makes us matter. And we will die if we don't matter. So habits of love are really a matter of life or death. Now, of course, there are some very bad things that we're exposed to, some toxic expectations, we call them, that can become what we call a negative reinforcement or a reinforcement of a negative behavior. And it reminded me of an article that I read not too long ago This actually came from a movie, but it was in culture. Unfortunately, it was in some of the Asian cultures, like the Japanese culture, long before it was brought into the U.S. or American popular culture. And it was in the movie Whiplash, right? Never saw the movie, but I have no problem judging a book by its cover. I think it's the easiest thing in the world. And here's what it was. This is a quote from Whiplash. It says, "The two most harmful words in the English language are good job." Seeming somehow in this performance-based element, somehow keeping the expectation of you can do better, you can do better, you can do better. That is a negative reinforcement or a reinforcement. Yes, a negative reinforcement. And it's a toxic expectation that we call perfectionism, that you can always do better or be better than you are right now. You know what? It is absolutely true. We can hone our craft. But the whole concept of the approval of good job being harmful, I think that's just nonsense. You can tell I kind of stumble over the whole thing because it's just so perplexing and puzzling to me. It is true. It may stimulate better performance. But humans are not about performance. The old saying in pop psychology is we are human beings, not human doings. It's not what we do that makes us valuable. We have intrinsic value, and that value needs to be rewarded. And when we do something spectacular, then we need to be patted on the head for that, right? We reward good behavior, we'll repeat it. And when we do something unacceptable, we need to be counseled, corrected. We need to have that noxious response to say, listen, that was something you and I both agreed we would never do again, and you did it, right? And it needs to come with a penalty, even if that penalty is only timeout. My PS on this is we have adult timeouts. Have you ever had your computer come to you and say, you know what you need to do? You need to close everything down and restart your computer. That's the adult version of timeout. Somewhere along the way, something you did said, you need to close Windows and restart everything. And that's what I call the adult version of timeout. But we live in a culture that is, unfortunately, a performance-based culture. And as a performance-based culture, we are typically perfectionistic and punitive. A punitive culture means we punish without reward. Perfectionism says, your reward is waiting for you when you can be just a little bit better, just a little bit more expert at what you're doing than you are right now. And then it's out there. You think about the carrot and the stick. Well, sometimes we get that saying just a little bit off. We don't really visualize it correctly. The carrot and the stick started with having an animal, let's say our plow mule, looking at a carrot dangled at the end of the stick just out of reach. Now just imagine if it was love, if it was approval, if it was acceptance that was just out of reach. And no matter how hard you tried, you could never get there. That's perfectionism. And unfortunately, that's the model our families and our entire culture and certainly our work is built on. How many times do we hear good job? How many times do we hear you need to do better? And no matter how well we do, we continue to have that carrot just beyond reach, that carrot of approval, of acceptance, that carrot of love, just beyond reach at the end of that stick. That's perfectionism, and that is toxic to the human spirit. Although I got to say, pretty good for people if you want performance. It's kind of like looking at the immune system and our habits of sleep. We sleep, we say between 7 to 9 hours is kind of optimum. But you know, if you're looking at the immune system has a little bit of a different take on things. If we're only looking at their immune response, we would say 7.5 hours is your minimum. And up around 8.25 hours is your optimum, right? 8.25 hours is different than 7 hours. Why would we ever say 7 and have that window of 7 to 9? It's because when we have 7 hours of sleep, we get locked into a state of arousal that mimics fight or flight, and we perform better. So So people actually perform better when they're slightly sleep deprived because they get locked into an emergency fight or flight circumstance. And I remember once upon a time there was a study that was done on naps, right, siestas. Could a person actually work better, perform better if they had a siesta in the afternoon halfway through their shift? And so they tried this out. They put a good number of people in the control group and an equal number of people, all gender matched and age matched, and they put them into the active group and they gave them an hour to go take a nap. And what they found was there was no increase in performance. Therefore, that went by the wayside. However, there was a reduction in accidents, injuries, sick days, and get this, there was a reduction in family violence. Domestic violence went down to near zero in the group that was taking a nap. But since those things were not part of performance, they weren't valued. And now we don't live in a siesta culture. However, what are the things that you and I value? Is it truly performance? Hey, performance has its place. But wouldn't we rather have a healthier immune system than being sleep deprived and able to perform a little bit better? Wouldn't we rather have a happy family life than being sleep deprived and able to perform a little bit better on our job? You see, perfectionism is a toxic expectation in a culture that rewards that kind of perfectionism. And, of course, punishes when a person doesn't want to join in that little perfectionistic march of the lemmings toward that far cliff. And those of you who've read the Lemming Syndrome know exactly what I'm talking about. We live in a perfectionistic and punitive culture. Approval is withheld until we can become just a little better than we are right now. That carrot is always beyond reach. The promised reward for meeting these escalating expectations is expressed as a promise of approval. It's expressed as a promise of acceptance. And here's where it gets really harsh. It's often expressed by parents and by spouses as withholding love until you can become just a little bit better than you are now. Well, all of us have experienced that. Perfectionism is also characterized by a noxious response for an unapproved behavior, right? Punished for the bad, never rewarded for the good. It's dangling just beyond a comfortable reach. Striving to meet those toxic expectations leads us to the habit of perpetually striving. We get into the habit of striving for more and more and more success or whatever it is that we're striving for. After a while, we forget why we're striving. We just strive because that's the habit. Along with perfectionism, I mentioned punitive. The punitive communication model is a reward is rarely or never given, but punishment for unapproved behavior is always readily present, always there. But we then, what happens? We only matter when we misbehave. So we literally bond to the abuse. And my viewpoint is the system that punishes without love, punishes without reward, punishes without acceptance is abusive. A punitive model of communication is toxic. The rewards of punishment as acceptance reinforce behavior. Because as we've discovered, we die if we don't matter. And if I only matter when I misbehave, then I will endure the abuse as a matter of survival. Misbehaving becomes a habit because it's consistently and predictably rewarded with attention. Now that attention may be punishment, but that's what we call a negative reward or rewarding negative behavior. Another common pathogenic attitude or toxic expectation in more of our advanced cultures is what we call the benign neglect. In this case, neglect by individuals who care about us but are simply otherwise engaged. They're just too busy. Those who should be enforcing and rewarding good behaviors, good habits, are nowhere to be found at the moment a habit can be ingrained. But if we get sick, this is important now, if we get sick, if we get injured, then the whole world stops and the spotlight shines on us, the victim. Of course, that only ensures that a person will get sick or injured again and again and again because it's a matter of survival. We die if we don't matter. If this habit makes us matter, we'll continue to repeat it. We'll get sick. We'll get injured. We'll have a crisis or a catastrophe. We'll live in a culture of victimhood because that makes us matter. That makes us feel loved. It's a toxic expectation. It's perpetuated by the victim-rescuer model of medicine. And this is something I have to say I was a part of for many, many years. Coaching helped me break out. So remember, breaking a bad habit will be successful when the habit itself, breaking a bad habit will never be successful when the habit was forged as a facet of acceptance. If you were only accepted, if you were only given attention when you were sick, you will always be sick until you yourself select different beliefs, different values, different thoughts, and now you're going to be able to break out of that habit. If you were only given attention when you misbehave, you will always misbehave unless you yourself decide this is no longer serving you and you form different habits, different beliefs, different values, different thoughts. Establishing a new habit will never be successful unless it's reinforced and rewarded, unless the new habit makes us matter to people who matter to us. Last time we got together, we went through our coaching questions, and at the beginning of this session, we also went through them. We're going to go through them again. How are you doing on your list? We were going to create and craft lists of A's, B's, and C's of the things that we want. And then we were going to spend some time with those A's, writing down what was important about them, and remembering that that would have an opportunity to change. It will change. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. But every step changes your perspective. So what do you want? What's on your A list? And what's important about what you want? And how has even looking at it, thinking about it, writing it down, how has that changed? What are your strengths when you are trying to marshal and rally your resources in order to get what you want? What are your strengths in doing that? What do you bring in the room when you walk into a room? How do other people see you? Who are you at your best? What are your weaknesses? What are the challenges in your own personality? And we all have them. Who are you at your worst? What are the gremlins that constantly take the wheels off of your tricycle, right? Or wings off of your airplane? What are the gremlins that are always trying to keep you from success? What is the voice of that inner counselor critic saying to you? And that's who you are at your worst. Now, with that in mind, what do you want? And are you clear about it? Then you'll have all the power you need to get there. Now it's time to decide, what should you do to get there? What will you do? And remember, we defined integrity as thought and action in harmony. When will it be done? We've arrived at our SMART goals. They are timely. So when will it be done and by whom will it be done? Because, you know, you can't do everything. And people are very, very happy to come along and help you finish that dream. We rate our overall scale of commitment on a scale of 1 to 10, our level of commitment, and then we want to always be doing the things necessary to escalate that level of commitment. Usually that means by uncluttering our life, taking away the things that are like barnacles on a ship, and slow down or de-escalate that level of commitment. We want to escalate it, and so we take away some of those barnacles. Here's an interesting tip. Clean your room, clean your desk, clean your car. A clean environment really does help you to think better. A cluttered environment, it means a cluttered mind. And that will help you simply by decluttering your life. It will help you escalate that scale of commitment. And we learned that habits are really a part of our accountability package, right? So how will we design accountability that will help us create better habits? Then we go about assigning tasks. We set up that reward and penalty, right? Reward for when we meet our short-term objectives, our long-term goals, and we make a step toward fulfilling our life of mission. And then also a penalty when we get ourselves sidetracked, right? Burns, the eminent psychologist he taught about putting a rubber band around your wrist. And when you do something that you know you shouldn't have done, or didn't do something you know you should have done, the penalty was snap that rubber band. Believe it or not, that really does help, but you look awfully silly over there snapping your rubber band every time you make a mistake. And then remember, for every step, for every new step, that new step gives you a new perspective. That new perspective means a new cycle of coaching. So stop trying to fix things. Start trying to understand them. Remember, a journey of 1,000 miles begins under your feet. You learn more from the people that are just ahead of you and just behind you than you will from somebody at the beginning or the end of the journey. In your own coaching career, just understand, these coaching calls are a great grounding for you. Invite people to next week's call, right? You'll need to opt in, they'll need to opt in. And then just remember, there are other certification levels that go up and up and up from here. Eventually, you're going to build a great coaching platform based on what we call natural affinity. You're going to coach people that are the most like you, and that's when the journey begins. We'll all have a chance to share those moments of clarity with people that are very much like we are and are on that same journey. Now the journey can become a real delight because we're sharing it with people that matter to us and creating our own immediate culture. Well, that's our call for this week. Thank you so much for paying attention and for being on the call. And we're going to look forward to sometime very soon being able to take these calls to a platform where we can have and the ability for us to actually communicate back and forth, a nice video platform on our computers. Until then, they're going to be posted to the website called SamuelJBrandt.com, SamuelJBrandt.com, that's my legacy LLC. Well, excuse me, it's SamuelJBrandtLLC.com. And that website then will host all of these calls. You'll be able to go there and read a little bit about my own story and my own life in coaching. And that's really not relevant. The most important thing is you'll be able to go to that site and pick up all of these coaching calls and listen to them again and again when you feel like you need a little help with self-coaching. So we'll see you next week. This has all been wonderful. Everyone have a really good evening. Bye now.